Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This is the third and final part of a three-part presentation of the story of Jim Wright of Cottage Grove and the replica racing plane he built following the patterns of the one that set all the records in the 1930s. It starts with a day of triumph, possibly the high point of Jim's professional life, the 2002 Reno Air Races. Jim and Betty Wright and their engineering team had a couple of goals in mind. In 2002, they wanted to go to the Reno Air Races and break the world speed record. Not the unlimited one that Hughes broke with his 70 years earlier. That one has been well out of reach for any gasoline-powered plane since about 1945. No, the record in the H-1 size class, which was 266 miles per hour, set in 1969. Wright had already had it above 300 while testing it around Cottage Grove. So, when the time came, the development team saddled up and headed for Reno. Wright made his hometown newspaper, Us, an offer. If a Sentinel staffer could get to Reno, he'd provide a hotel room. This was a big deal. Booking a room in Reno during the weekend of the air races was almost impossible. It took some fancy talking and some heavy-duty promising, but I secured permission from the publisher to empty out the newsroom for the weekend. All three of us, reporter Treader, photographer Paben, and me, bundled into a borrowed Volkswagen van and launched ourselves on a road trip to Reno. When we got there, we found the Wrights holding court, or rather, court was holding them. They weren't trying to be the center of attention, but their airplane had the effect of emptying out all the other areas of the air show. It was parked right next to a Bell P-63 King Cobra, an extremely rare World War II fighter plane. The Bell got very little attention in the shadow of the H-1, but its owner, delighted at the chance to look at the historic replica at close range, didn't seem to mind in the least. At Reno, there's an air show on the ground where visitors can look over historic and interesting planes and eat cotton candy at the same time air races are going on above, with pilots roaring around pylons at wide-open throttle, jockeying for position in a quest for that checkered flag. Wright, of course, would never endanger his plane by racing it against other aircraft, so he stuck with the air show part of the program. Treader and Paben and I watched the air races from the tarmac with him and the rest of the H-1 team. I was doing something else, not paying any attention to the planes buzzing overhead, when an electric current seemed to go through the crowd, and I felt, rather than heard, a collective gasp. I looked up. A tall plume of dust was rising from the desert floor on the opposite side of the airfield. I couldn't see it, but at the bottom of that plume was a plane that had just broken apart in midair and hammered into the ground. There was no parachute. There were no survivors. It was a sobering reminder that this wasn't a stamp-collecting convention. These people were here to do something that sooner or later would kill some of them. We went back to the hotel after that and had a couple drinks. And very early the next morning, again without telling us what he was up to, Wright took the plane out again and shattered the record he'd come to break. Disappointed but getting used to it by now, we hurried home and splashed the news all over the front page. Wright's speed was 304 miles an hour. He said he could have gone faster, but the propeller still wasn't working quite right, so he could only get 65% power to it. Maybe even bigger counterweights were needed. Well, I never saw Wright again after that day in Reno. Shortly afterward, I was transferred to the Corvallis newspaper, but I followed his exploits avidly in the Sentinel, where Treader had taken over as editor. Wright, his first record broken, now had set his sights on the transcontinental record, the one Hughes had broken back in 1937. A race against the clock from one side of the North American continent to the other, which still seemed within striking distance of the H-1's capabilities. But first there was a summer full of appearances and air shows, starting with the Experimental Aviation Association show in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, early in August 2003. This was the big one, and Jim wouldn't miss it for anything. So he fired up his plane and headed for Oshkosh. The plane was, of course, the highlight of the show, as it had been everywhere. Pilots lined up to gawk at it. On the way home from the show, Wright landed in Gillette, Wyoming, where he and his plane caused a mild sensation, according to the local paper. But the paper reported Wright said something ominous. He was having propeller trouble. Again.
"The air is thin enough here that the propeller gets stuck in low gear," he said. "I'm just trying to get home."
By which he meant that the counterweights, once again, wouldn't let his propeller take big enough bites of air. Things were fine when he took off from lower elevations, but up in the Rocky Mountains he was having trouble again. Wright climbed up on a ladder and worked the propeller hub over, making sure it was well lubricated. No doubt he figured that worst-case scenario, he'd have to limp home at 30% power again. No fun, but he'd done it before. Then, with his parachute on, he always said if there were ever trouble he'd bail out, he strapped himself back into the airplane and took off, headed for home. An hour or so later, at Yellowstone National Park, a group of tourists was looking at geysers when they heard a very loud airplane engine start with a sudden shaggy roar close behind them. It sounded troubled and uneven. Then, with a cough, it went silent again. Looking up, they saw a small silver airplane right above the treetops. It was headed right for them. Its wings were wobbling as if it were about to stall and crash. What they didn't know was what would come out in the National Transportation Safety Board's analysis of the wreckage later on. The propeller had thrown off one of those two counterweights. As a result, one blade was taking tiny nibbles of air, and the other was taking big bites. Running the engine with a propeller like that could shake an airplane so violently that it could actually break apart. Apparently, when this happened, Wright had cut power and let his plane glide. It made a fabulous glider, but of course, Wright needed a place to glide it to, or he'd have to bail out and let it crash. He was ready for that. That's what the parachute was for. But Wright's friends think he looked down and saw that geyser basin and thought, "I can land on that." So he stayed in the plane and lined it up for an emergency landing, gear up so that it would bounce on the ground like a skipping stone rather than sticking in the field and tumbling end over end, and going just as slow as possible to reduce the impact damage. Then, the theory goes, when he got close enough, he saw the tourists, at least 20 of them, standing right where he needed to land. If he put the plane down there, he'd mow them down like cornstalks in October. He started the engine up again. The plane began to shake violently. Wright's crippled plane couldn't make enough power to save itself without shaking itself to pieces. He shut it off again. He was flying as slow as the plane would go without stalling. Standard procedure for an emergency landing. He was just a few hundred feet off the ground. Every time an airplane turns, it loses a little speed. If he tried to turn anyway, the plane would stall out and spin straight into those people. So turning his plane away from the people to land it on another part of the geyser basin was not an option. He had just two choices: save himself and his plane by potentially covering it with their blood, or put it into a dive to gain enough speed to turn it away from them, knowing it would slice into the ground wing first at 100 miles an hour if he did. No one who knew Jim Wright would be surprised by the choice he made. The news of Jim Wright's death hit Cottage Grove hard. Everyone in the community had heard him roaring overhead in that distinctive-sounding airplane. Hundreds of people drove to nearby Springfield for his memorial service, and the city council immediately started the process of naming the Cottage Grove State Airport. It's now also known as Jim Wright Field. Around that same time, a letter arrived addressed to Jim Wright's bereaved family. It was from the Chen family, Ning and Mei Ling, and their 12-year-old son Ian, who were among those tourists in the clearing. They described the scene in a letter forwarded to Wright's family by a Yellowstone Park ranger.
"The plane was heading directly toward my wife and several other people on the boardwalk," Ning Chen wrote. "The plane was about 500 feet away from her at a height of 300 to 400 feet. She and other people were directly under the flight path. The next thing I observed was that the plane all of a sudden veered to its right. After two or three more seconds, I saw a huge explosion from the creek next to the main road. The plane started to swerve away from the boardwalk, flipped perpendicular to the ground, and crashed into a small hill near the river wing first," wrote Ian. "Later, my family figured out that the pilot swerved away so that he would not endanger the lives of the people on the ground, which also included my mom. I realize Mr. Wright really spared the lives of the people on the ground," wrote Mei Ling Chen. "It must have been really hard for him to make that decision at that final moment. I'm writing this letter to let you know what an honorable man he was. Our family is very grateful for his actions."
Key sources in this story included back issues of the Cottage Grove Sentinel and the Gillette, Wyoming News Record, AAFO.com, Air and Space Magazine from May of 2003, the NTSB Accident Report, an email from Dennis Parker to Oregon Magazine, October 2002, and the personal recollections of Matthew Treader and me, Finn Jung. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.